Okay, we are on Perek Tzadik Tes, chapter 99. Or 99. This is the 10th of 11 chapters that were written by Moshe Rabbeinu. We started on Perek 90 with the chapters that were written by Moshe Rabbeinu. And we've asked, how is it possible that there's something written by Moshe Rabbeinu? We don't see anywhere in the Chumash Moshe Rabbeinu writing anything other than what Hashem told him to write. Yes? We don't see Moshe Rabbeinu writing anything other than what Hashem told him. We don't see him saying, take a little break and go do some creative writing now. Right? But everything is very, you know, organized, write this, write this. We don't see really a lot of Moshe Rabbeinu writing anything on his own. So one of the things that we suggested is that there's a midrash that in Mitzrayim, the Bnei Yisrael had scrolls that they used to read each week that had psukim on them that gave them encouragement, that gave them divrei chizuk, and there were 11 of these scrolls. So happens that Moshe Rabbeinu also wrote 11 kapitulach. So it's not a big stretch to think that perhaps that before he ever was sent to Paro, and before he was ever the Moshe Rabbeinu leader of the people that we read in the Chumash, that perhaps he wrote these, and those were the scrolls that they had in Mitzrayim. We don't know that for a fact, but it's quite possible that that was it. It's also possible that just because it doesn't say in the Chumash that Moshe Rabbeinu exercised his own creative writing, you know, he very well could have written, you know, his own expressions, his own verses. But for whatever purpose, David HaMelech had those scrolls for Moshe Rabbeinu. He had the things that Moshe Rabbeinu had written, and he adapted them and put them into Tehillim in these 11 kapitulach. Each one of the kapitulach, we have a tradition that each one represents and talks about the character of a certain tribe, of one of the 12 shvatim. Now, once again, we're forced to do complicated math. Does 12 shvatim equal 11 kapitulach? And the answer, of course, is no. Somebody's missing. So the tradition tells us that the tribe of Shimon was left out because of the fact that Zimri, remember from the Chumash, Zimri was the one that Pinchas slew and killed for his outrageous behavior in front of the entire Klal Yisrael. So Moshe Rabbeinu did not dedicate a kapitel to the tribe of Shimon. So therefore we have 11 kapitulach dedicated to 11 out of the 12 tribes, each kapitul a certain aspect of something about that particular tribe. This particular kapitul, the Rishayim tell us, is dedicated to the tribe of Dan. Now the tribe of Dan were known as warriors, and in fact the bracha they have that they will be able to conquer all of the enemies in Hashem's name. And this particular kapitul is going to mention, and we'll see in just a minute, the time as Mashiach comes when there's war and upheaval. And that time of war and upheaval will be a chance for the tribe of Dan to shine in their warrior capacity. Therefore, this particular kapitel is said to discuss the attribute that is most related to the tribe of Dan. It's also, of course, part of Kabbalah Shabbos service. Now, the Kabbalah Shabbos service was something that was unknown in the times of the Talmud and in the times up until the early 1500s when the Arizal and the Kabbalists in Sfas would go out into the fields to greet the Shabbos week. They would dress in white and they would go out to the fields, and while they were out there, they would say Tehillim to greet the Shabbos week. And the Tehillim they would say is what we call the Kabbalah Shabbos service. So therefore, that's the Kabbalah Shabbos service is a custom that we adopted from the Arizal, and it was never officially an enactment from Chazal, and has no official basis anywhere in the written Torah. Therefore, in Shul, whoever's leading the Kabbalah Shabbos service will do it from a different place than they normally lead all of the other davenings. So for example, if there's a small shtender in front up by the Arim, where typically the person leading davening would stand, instead for Kabbalah Shabbos service, he'll go back and stand by the bima, to indicate that even though this is a great and holy thing that we're doing, It was not something that was officially enacted by Chazal, but rather a custom that we adopted from the Arizal. All of these kapitulot that we're involved in right now talk about the times of Mashiach. Now, other kapitulot have talked about different aspects of Mashiach. One of the things that we haven't really mentioned extensively is the fact that the coming of Mashiach is also a time of war and upheaval, or can be a time of war and upheaval. We have to preface everything we say about Mashiach with the fact that we'll know how it's going to happen when it happens. Most of what we know, or think we know, about the coming of Mashiach is how the Rishonim understand the various nevuahs, the various prophecies that were given to us. And it often seems like there's contradictory statements and contradictory understandings. Perhaps they are contradictory, perhaps they speak of different aspects. There's a lot that's not very clear. But one of the things that Chazal tell us is that there's something called the War of Gog and Magog. That at the times of Mashiach, there'll be a massive war where the nation of Magog, led by the fellow named Gog, will start some sort of cataclysmic war involving the Jewish people. During that war, the leader of the Jewish people, who is called Mashiach ben Yosef, who will be a descendant of Yosef, will be killed in battle. And the Mashiach ben David, what we usually think of as the Mashiach who will reign, will somehow be responsible for leading these armies. Hashem will miraculously save the Jewish people and enter in the era of Mashiach. How's that for vague? And of course, this upheaval, some of the Rishonim say, will happen before Mashiach arrives and before we know who he is. Some say it will happen in the process of Mashiach coming, and some say it'll be the first thing Mashiach does after he's already here. So how's that for even vaguer? So somehow, though, we see throughout the entire Talmud that Chazal understood that somehow connected with the times of Mashiach, there's some sort of cataclysmic upheaval, whatever it may be. And these birth pangs of Mashiach, as the Talmud calls them, are something that Chazal said they wish to be saved from. It's so bad that they don't want to live through this birth pangs of Mashiach. Now, it could be that... What does that mean? Well, you know also that Mashiach can come either at what we call the appointed time, meaning time's run out, and it's the end of the time that Hashem allotted, or if we're worthy, Mashiach can come even sooner than that. So perhaps when Mashiach comes affects what kind of cataclysm there'll be. It's all a little vague, and you can read many, many books that will go through in great detail how it's going to happen. Pick up another book which will go in great detail completely differently as to how it's going to happen. In general, we understand from the Rambam that the times of Mashiach are physically like we are now. We have bodies, we live in the world. We're not just sort of ethereal forces floating around somewhere. However, the nature of the world and the nature of physicality will be quite different. People will live very long lives. The nature of the earth and what it produces will be very different. It won't need so much effort in order for crops to grow, etc. There's a lot of differences that will occur, but it's basically going to be physically very similar to what we know now. And we said a couple of kapitulot ago that Hashem will reign, and we've talked about everybody will exult and the earth will be happy, and we've talked about all of the wonderful feelings that are going to happen when this time of Mashiach comes. However, in this kapitul, we see in verse 1, we're adding something new here. Before all that happens, what has to happen is Hashem Malach, the Lord reigns, Yirgazu Amim, and the nations will quake with fear. Yoshev Keruvim Tanu Ta'aretz. And before Hashem, who dwells between the Keruvim, the earth will falter. So now, what Moshe Rabbeinu and David HaMelech are telling us is before we get to all of that other stuff, somehow or other the nations have to quake and tremble before Hashem. most likely a reference to the war of Gog and Magog, but something for the era of Mashiach to come in, the nations have to somehow realize that they should be quaking before Hashem. Now, obviously, when it says that Hashem dwells between the Kerubim, that's a metaphor, that's a mushroom. He doesn't really dwell in one specific place. But before we get to all the exalting and all of the wonderful things that we've talked about in the times of Mashiach and how amazing our lives will be, first of all, the nations have to shake before Hashem. Whatever that's going to mean, that's what has to happen first. The fifth goes on in the next verse in Pasuk Bey to say, Hashem b'tzion gadol v'ramhu akol ha'ami. Hashem is great in Tzion, and he is high as Ram over all the peoples. And what this verse is saying is that Hashem is gadol is how we see Hashem. We see Hashem, and we describe him as gadol, meaning he's great, and he's involved in every aspect of the world. So even from the most lofty concepts of how the stars rotate to whether or not your job goes well tomorrow, every detail of the world Hashem is involved in. But then other nations, other than the Jews, they see the Ramu. They see him as high. They see Hashem as remote, not involved in the day-to-day things of the world. The nations of the world don't see and have necessarily that connection, that understanding that Hashem is involved in every smallest detail of the world. They see him as Ram, as exalted, a great king who we go visit sometimes, but who certainly doesn't bother us in our day-to-day lives. We see Hashem as Gadol. So the Pasuk says, Hashem b'tzion Gadol. B'tzion with us is Gadol. He's involved in everything. Ram hu akol ha'amim. The other nations, they see him as Ram. They see him as a big exalted king off in the distance. Come the future, they'll realize that Hashem is really Gadol. Something has to wake up the nations of the world. We talk about the fact that, you know, Hashem echad, Ushma echad, and all of the nations will realize. Well, how's that? Is that just going to happen one day at 9:03 p.m., right? All the nations of the world are going to suddenly realize they were wrong for the last 3,000 years. There's going to be something that's going to make them realize they were wrong. And realize that Hashem is not Ram. Hashem is not some faraway king, but Hashem is literally involved with every minute detail of the world. And it continues in the next verse in Pasuk Gimel to say, Yodu Shimcha, they'll know his name, Gadol v'Nara Kadoshu. They'll realize that he's Gadol and that he's Nara. And then it says Kadoshu. Kadosh is also a reference to how even after all that happens, the nations of the world still won't quite get it to the full extent. They'll see Hashem as Kadosh. Everything that has to do with Kedusha involves Hashem. But it's going to be harder for them to realize that Hashem is also involved with how long the battery in my cell phone lasts and every detail like that. They'll see him Gadol, they'll see Nora, but they'll still have the trouble with Kadosh. We can understand it by looking at the world around us that we live in, the Western world, the quote-unquote Christian world. Right? What do they live by? Give Hashem what's Hashem and Caesar what's Caesar's. If you see how the nations in the Western world worship Hashem, they do it in a very stiff and separate manner. Hashem is something that once a week we go and we pay tribute to the king. And even those people in the Western world who are observant of their religion, I'm not talking people just giving lip service, people who truly believe that they should be worshiping Hashem, they consider it like going off to the distant land and paying tribute to the king, and then coming back home. When they're back home, what does it have to do with the king off in the distant land? Non-Jewish nations, especially those that have come through the Western tradition, don't understand or have a way to relate to Hashem as something that's involved in every detail of their life. And this is why, right, the Western world cannot live with the Eastern and Muslim societies. It makes them crazy. Now, let's forget a moment terrorism and all the things that any sane person would be scared of. Let's talk about a peaceful Muslim society. going about their lives and not wishing to interfere with anybody else's life. Why does it make people in America so crazy that they exist? They can't be comfortable with the existence of a Muslim society, nor with any of these societies that involve Hashem in their lives. They don't know how to. They don't. It makes them uncomfortable, because to them, Hashem is something they go off and see and pay tribute to the king and come back. It's kadosh. Oh, you know what? It's our day to do something kadosh. So we're going to go and we're going to worship Hashem and we're going to acknowledge His greatness. Then we're going to go back home. They can't understand and relate to Hashem as something that involves in every aspect of their lives. And that's why Western civilization is just uncomfortable with everything to do with Eastern or Muslim societies. In the most peaceful Muslim society in the world, Allah is involved in every finite detail of their life. That makes people in the West uncomfortable. What is it that makes people uncomfortable? What is it that makes Jews who don't observe traditional Torah Judaism uncomfortable about those who do?
Just hearing about it, because I was raised in that type of an atmosphere. Just hearing about it makes them uncomfortable.
Just hearing about it makes them uncomfortable. So part of it, probably guilt, right?
You don't even know why.
But a lot of it is uncomfortable. They're uncomfortable with the fact that God is involved in their life all the time. It makes them uncomfortable. So says the Pasuk, and you know what? Even after they say, the nations say, that Gadol, okay, Hashem is great, he's involved in the whole world, they still see it as Kadosh. It's still something that, it's Kedusha time? We have to worship Hashem. Right? And I hope my bread comes out okay. They don't have a hard time connecting that with Hashem. That's the avoda that the nations of the world have to work on. Even the people that recognize Hashem and worship Hashem do it in this kind of Ram way where he's the exalted faraway king. And he's Kadosh. Right? But involved in daily life, it makes them sort of uncomfortable. Come the future, they're going to have to realize some cataclysmic event is going to have to make them realize that Hashem is involved in every waking moment of the world. And when that comes, then the whole world will worship Hashem. It goes on to say in Pasuk Dalet, V'oiz Melech, Mishpat Ahev, the mighty king, he loves righteousness and judgment. Ato Konante Mesharim, he founded righteousness, Mishpat Tzedakah, judgment and pure justice, the Yaakov Ata Asisa. And in judgment, in this righteousness, you made it into Yaakov. Well, that's interesting. So Oz Melech, he loves justice. Is that a big compliment? Hashem loves justice. Have you ever seen a just system of justice in the world that treats everybody fairly?
No.
Is it possible to guarantee me to walk into any court in the United States of America and guarantee me that all parties are receiving fair and equitable justice no matter what?
No.
Far from it. Fine, there may be cases of equitable, but certainly far from a guaranteed thing. And Hashem loves justice. Nobody is above the law. That's a chiddush. That's a groundbreaking event. When Hashem gave us the Torah, and the Torah says, you know what? Everybody who comes before the court is equal. People laughed at that in the rest of the world. What kind of crazy idea is that? You mean a rich person should get the same justice as a poor person? What kind of laws do you guys have? That was considered to be crazy talk. It's not just 3,000 years ago. Look around today and you see the same thing. Hashem likes justice. Hashem likes, it is a big compliment. It is a big thing because the world doesn't run that way. Right, we say in Shemona Esrei, bring back the judges. We want fair justice. You want to be able to walk into a court and know that justice is going to happen. In the next pasuk in pasuk Hey, says Romamu Hashem Elokeinu Veishtachavu LaHagon Raglav Kadoshi. Exalt Hashem, bow down to His footstool, for it is holy. So exalt Hashem means that it's not enough for you to feel happy and content and, I'm looking for the right word, glad for what Hashem did for you. Exalting Hashem means you have to tell other people about it. You have to tell other people about it as well. You know, the job of the Jewish people is to be a light unto the nation. That's the whole purpose. How's that supposed to work? What's supposed to happen is that the people of the world are supposed to see the Jewish nation and see how Jews conduct themselves and be so impressed and say, wow, if that's what a person is who worships Hashem, I want to do that too. That's our job in the world. How's that working?
It has
its ups and downs, all right? Certainly there are some people who fulfill that, but as a nation, we're struggling with it. In fact, sometimes if you look at Jewish history, and you look at the things that Hashem punished us for, like during the times of the first Beis HaMikdash or the second Beis HaMikdash, if you compare the way the Jews behave, the nations around them, we're tremendous tzaddikim. And it seems like every little tiny whiny thing, boom, Hashem has to come down on us. Right? Look around. You got idol-worshipping pagans on your left and on your right here who would as soon cut off your head and eat it. Right? And here we are, you know, doing a pretty good job of keeping the Torah. Oh, no, not good enough. Why so particular with us? Hey, look over here at these pagans. Okay, you know, take a look at these guys. Right? Because if your job is to be a light among the nations, there's very, very little room. There's very little room for error. You may be doing a better job than the nations around you, but you're not being a light unto the nations. Therefore, you're not doing your job. You're not doing your job, you don't get the tools you need to do your job anymore. If you give someone a hammer every day and he's supposed to be a carpenter, and after 6 months he hasn't built a single thing because he can't figure out which end of the hammer to use, you're probably going to take the hammer back and give it to someone else. So if you're a light amongst the nations, there's not really a lot of room for falling off of that platform there. You can't just say, well, I'm better than all these evil nations around me. Because you're held to a higher standard than that. They're not just supposed to look at you and say, hey, look, those Jewish people aren't any worse than us. They're supposed to look at you and say, wow, the Jewish nation, that's pretty impressive. That's what happened under Shlomo HaMelech. When we reached the pinnacle under David HaMelech and Shlomo HaMelech, and we had the Beis HaMikdash, they had to make a rule that nobody could convert to Judaism. Because everybody wanted to be Jewish. There wouldn't be any non-Jews left in the world. And they couldn't tell whether people were sincere or whether they just wanted to be part of the greatest, awesomest nation ever in the world. I mean, to be a Jew in Shlomo HaMelech's land didn't get better than that. Spiritually, materially, every way you can imagine, the Jews were at the pinnacle and everybody looked and said, we want to be like that. It didn't last long, but that's what it means to exalt the Shem. You have to spread it around. You can't just keep it in your own private closet and expect to accomplish what you need to accomplish. You have to exalt the Shem. It says, after you exalt him, bow down to his footstool. So his footstool could either mean the earth in general, or most people think it means the Beis HaMikdash. And there's a medrash that connects the first half of the pasuk and the second half seem to be sort of unconnected. Exalt Hashem and bow down to the Beis HaMikdash. Sorry, it doesn't seem all that connected, but the medrash says the first and the two parts are connected. Because when you exalt Hashem, then you're worthy of bowing down and get the Beis HaMikdash. That it's not you're supposed to do two separate things, that if you properly reflect the way Hashem wants you to be a light among the nations, then you'll be able to bow down to the Beis HaMikdash. You know, we've talked about there's a number of families in the area that are moving to Eretz Yisrael soon. So it used to be that when you went to Eretz Yisrael, you took the 11 bus and you went over and you got off at the Beis HaMikdash. And you went and you saw the Shekhinah and you saw the Nisim and you saw the smoke and you saw everything happening. And that was a good pick-me-up for the end of the day. But in order to get that, in order to be worthy of bowing down to the Beis HaMikdash, you have to exalt Hashem. And the next pasuk in pasuk Vav is Moshe v'Aaron v'Kohanim. And Moses and Aaron amongst the Kohanim, Ushmuel, and Shmuel and Navi, The Korei Shemo are those who called his name. Korei Mel Hashem, they would call out to Hashem, Vahu Ya'ane, and he would answer them. Moshe and Aaron, we understand. I mean, talk about the base of Mikdash. The original Mishkan was served in by Moshe and Aaron. All of a sudden we jump to Shmuel. 400 years later. So Chazal tell us that besides being the greatest Navi after Moshe Rabbeinu, Shmuel did something similar to what Moshe Rabbeinu did, and that they both gave Klal Yisrael something eternal. Moshe Rabbeinu gave us the Torah from Hashem, and we were supposed to go and get a king to live in the land under the Torah. But it wasn't until Shmuel Anavi that Shmuel anointed a king. Shmuel Anavi anointed Shaul, of course, and then David. So Shmuel Anavi gave us something everlasting as well. So therefore, he's mentioned in the same breath as Moshe and Aaron. In Pasuk Zion, it says, "V'amud anan yedaber aleihem shamru edaisav v'chayk nasan la." In a pillar of cloud, he would speak to them. They kept all of his laws and the commandments that he gave them. So the pillar of cloud refers to Moshe and Aaron, because the Medrash tells us that there would be a cloud, the pillar of cloud, over the Olam Moed when Hashem was talking to Moshe Rabbeinu. But the Medrash goes on further to say that Shmuel Anavi had a cloud over his house, a similar cloud over his house. And that when Shaul needed to find out where Shmuel lived, they told him, look for the cloud. They called to Hashem, and he would answer them. Hashem Elokeinu, Atah Nisa. Hashem, he goes on next verse, you answered them. Keil Noisea Yisalahem, you were forgiving. Benokim Alalisam, but vengeful for their misdeeds. So many times Moshe Rabbeinu sighs, goes back to Hashem, okay, please forgive these people. Moshe Rabbeinu is always asking Hashem to forgive us. And he did. And Hashem did. And it would seem like after that we got a lot better. Until the next time. I heard from Rav Hanan in Eretz Yisrael an interesting thing. He said, you know, how is it that the Jews who were wantonly doing whatever particular aveira they were doing, Moshe Rabbeinu has to go and ask for forgiveness. Hashem says, I forgive you, and we're all happy and ready to do good again. He says, how is it that the Jewish people could all of a sudden change their attitude just because Moshe Rabbeinu said, well, I'll go ask for forgiveness for you. Interesting. He says that what inspired the Jewish people was that Moshe Rabbeinu asking Hashem to forgive the Jewish people was a demonstration that no matter what they did and no matter how poorly they performed, Moshe Rabbeinu still believed in it. Hashem would say no. Moshe would say, yes, please. On and on. Well, look at these. Hashem made him a great deal. You know what? I'll get you another people. These guys, you know what? They don't listen for what? All right? I'm going to get you a much better people. We're going to do this again. And you know what? We won't have to have all this. No. And Moshe Rabbeinu is saying, no, these are the people. These are, you have to forgive them. You know, otherwise people will do this. And he's saying, on and on. Why Hashem should forgive these people? Take the new people already. These guys aren't doing that great. Moshe Rabbeinu believed in the Jewish people. And because he believed in the Jewish people, and asked and davened so hard, Hashem forgave them. And when the people saw that Moshe Rabbeinu believed in them, they were able to turn themselves around. Never underestimate the power of knowing that someone believes in you. But the second half of the pasuk, you were vengeful for their misdeeds. Oops. We're going so well with the forgiving thing. Now all of a sudden, we see also that sometimes, you know what? Hashem comes down, and he looks, use the expression, like a ton of bricks. Moshe Rabbeinu is supposed to ask the rock, and he strikes it. Teeny, teeny mistake. Kaboom. Aaron's sons, they meant to offer a korban right. Boom, they gotta die. What's with the forgiving? What happened to the forgiving? Everything Moshe Rabbeinu has done, little teeny mess up, I would think that Hashem would say, oh, Moshe, okay, fine, you know what?
be a little more careful next time. Would you follow directions a little better? Instead, there are times when Hashem comes down and there is no quarter given, no quarter asked. That's it. He slightly didn't do what I said. It's all over. So we know why Hashem forgives us. Hashem forgives us so that we'll be encouraged and go on. What's the point of Hashem coming down like that? Does he think that Hashem think that Moshe Rabbeinu is going to run off and do all kinds of avers if he doesn't punish him quickly? I don't think so. Chazal tells the point of Hashem of Hashem coming down like that is for the Jewish people to see something. And to see something, and that is Hashem is capable of fast, decisive, and extremely accurate punishment for those who deserve it. Come some point in the future, that's the kind of punishment that the enemies of Klal Yisrael are going to receive. It's hard to believe in something you never saw. All we think of Hashem is that he always forgives. Well, yeah, come the future, he's going to forgive all those crazy Nazis also. The pasuk doesn't work that way. Hashem forgives sometimes, but you keep your eyes open and see that, you know what? Hashem can also come down like that. So come lasid lavo, when it comes time to judge the nations of the world, don't worry and don't falter in your belief that Hashem will come down on them like they deserve. Hashem will give them exactly what they deserve. For sometimes Hashem answers and forgives, and sometimes Hashem is vengeful for their misdeeds. In the last pasuk, there's only 9 verses in this kapitel, it says, Romamu Hashem Elokeinu, Veishtachavu Lahar Kodshoi, Yikadosh Hashem Elokeinu. Exalt Hashem and bow down to His sanctuary, for Hashem is holy. Now we said before that you should bow down to the base of Mikdash. We seem to have spread out a little bit. Now we're bowing down just sort of to Hashem's general holiness and His holy areas. So Chazal tell us an interesting thing, and that is that seeing Hashem's holy places can bring a person to appreciate Hashem more. Anybody who's been to Eretz Yisrael can testify to that. Even if it's only a place that they set up from the tourist commission, and may or may not have ever really been, you know, whatever they claim it is, you can't go and see Hashem's places of Kedusha and not feel something. So it's okay to go and bow down to places that are holy because Hashem did something there or something happened there. But going to such places is actually a good thing. As a person goes and he prostrates himself metaphorically, literally, or whatever, in these places, and he sees, and it brings him to appreciate Hashem. We can't just appreciate Hashem just by looking up and wanting to see Hashem. We can only appreciate what He does. So when we go and we see Hashem's holy places, it brings a person to appreciate Hashem more. Not only is there nothing wrong with that, that's a good thing. 9 Pesukim. The tribe of Dan, the warriors, are going to be involved in this cataclysmic event that's going to change the way the world looks at Hashem. We see Hashem as involved in everything. The world doesn't necessarily understand that, but they will at the times of Mashiach. And we'll see that Hashem loves justice and that everybody will be treated completely fairly, and those who deserve a quick and decisive end will get it, and those who deserve forgiveness will get that as well. And you see in the past all the great people, Moshe and Aaron and Shmuel, that have believed this and have dedicated their life to it. It's interesting because I was thinking about the theme of this, and I thought what I thought, and I like to look in Rabbi Rubin's book on Tehillah. He has, before every kapitel, he has a story about something that happened to him. He's been a rabbi in England for, I don't know, 500-600 years. Oops, that's not on the tape now. And there are stories about different things that happened to him and how it made him think of this or that. And I opened it up, and it literally was the exact same muscle that I thought of. Right? So it makes me feel that perhaps it's got something to it. And that, it was, I started thinking of it because my son, same one who's off somewhere, recently became a certified lifeguard. And we were talking about what he had to do in order to become a lifeguard. And one of the things that we discuss is that when you jump in the pool or the ocean or wherever, to save a drowning person, the drowning person is often fighting you. And they have to learn how to get the person out of the water while the person's fighting against them. The person is drowning, the person is scared, right? And the person is flailing around pretty hard. So they have to learn maneuvers to get under the person, and they have to actually save someone who's struggling as hard as possible not to be saved.
They don't know it.
They don't know it. What a great muscle, what a great metaphor for the world today. People are flailing around, not even realizing that someone's trying to save them. And it's a struggle. You know, they use in the media, pointed this out, but also they call everything a war. There's a culture war and a class war. This, everything is called a war. That's the term the media uses whenever there's any kind of disagreement. It's a war about this or that. So it sounds like they're exaggerating, but the truth is not that much. Everything is a war today. People are flailing around, and they don't understand that the lifeguard is trying to save them. The point of this capitulo, there's something to have in mind when reading or saying this capitulo, is that no matter how much we flail around, and no matter how much we resist it, there's going to come a day. And on that day, Hashem is going to use his lifeguard maneuvers to pull us out. And on that day, when he pulls us out of the water using his lifeguard maneuvers, there's going to be a din v'chashvin, who gets punished, who gets forgiven, right, etc. And the fact that it looks cataclysmic, people are drowning and flailing, there's wars going on, doesn't mean that the lifeguard is not there pulling you out. But there's going to come a time when the flailing is going to even get worse, but Hashem is still there, and Hashem will pull us out through that day for the reward on the other side. That's the message of this capitulo. Is that yes, we want to get to here, to what we call the times of Mashiach. But there's a big bumpy roller coaster over here on the way. Well, it doesn't matter how much we're flailing. Oh, I just messed up my metaphor with water. There's a big ocean here that we're flailing through to get there. Forget the roller coaster. There's a big ocean that we're flailing through to get there. Well, Hashem's going to pull us out with lifeguards. He has his lifeguard maneuvers. The same way the lifeguards can come in, they can pull you out. You don't even know how they got you out. Most people who are saved from drowning by a lifeguard have no idea how they got out of the water. They were flailing around. They don't even remember that some guy had them and pulled them out. Even if they remember what happened, they don't have any conception of how they were so busy flailing that they have no idea how they got out of the water. They just know there was a huge, horrible thing, and now they're okay on the beach. That's how it's going to be. There's going to be more. There's going to be a bunch of flailing, right? But even though there's going to be this bunch of flailing, and there's going to be a Gog and a Magog and a this and a that, and who knows what kind of cataclysmic things it's going to be, Hashem has got his arm around you, under your arms, and he's pulling you out to the beach. And once he pulls you out to the beach, and you're done flailing, you're not even sure how you got through all the flailing, the beach on the other side, everything that you've been waiting for. That's the message of this kid. Questions?
Moshe Rabbeinu wrote this. How could he mention his name?
Yes, David. Most people say that David did some editing or adapting. Unlike some of the kapitulot that were written by others, most of the Forashim are not clear that it's exactly every word from Moshe Rabbeinu. The David HaMelech may have done some editing or adapting. Right? It's not exactly clear, but it's quite possible that David HaMelech, you know, that David HaMelech put in, like Moshe and Aaron and Shmuel. You know, Moshe Rabbeinu wouldn't say, like, I was so great. All right? But he wrote the verses, and perhaps David HaMelech put in, and you see an example of this in Moshe and Aaron and Shmuel. Good question. Any other questions? Okay, next week we will finish the last of Moshe Rabbeinu's kapitulah, and then we will be back to kapitulah written by...